But most of them, you know, will still use euphemisms for what they're doing, or they don't understand all the details. But there's not a dispute about what's actually going on. I wish there were.
No, not in. I mean, there is in the margins, but it's kind of rightly termed the lunatic fringe. Just, I mean, you obviously disassociate yourself from that, or perhaps you don't even have to. I've had to disassociate myself from the conspiracy field because it's even though they have a lot of the correct data, they create a narrative out of it, which, as you've pointed out, is false. It's exaggerated and it's oversimplified and it's actually it lacks all the nuance. So there is this discussion going on, but it's not really grounded.
Yeah, I'm busy. I fell into this story. I don't go didn't go looking for it. And I
Right.
have people occasionally they're like going, "Have you ever looked into the Masons?" I'm like, "Nope. Don't care." You know, if I call it my three tap rule. And under the three tap rule, until I have, without looking, fallen across something as being pertinent at least three times, I won't look into it. And by the time I decide it's pertinent and decide to look into it, I will figure out exactly how it fits in so that when I talk about it, it won't seem like I've got a conspiratorial frame of mind because I don't. But I do understand from history that history tells us that anytime, anywhere in the world, when economic and political power can collude and join together, they will. And where you had the rise of respecting the individual, it was generally where governments were unable to collude in the manner that they would have liked to. And so it's not that they allowed the growth of the individual. They allowed the growth of people to do their own things. They just weren't able to prevent it. And now, using the behavioral sciences and education, using these laws that nobody wants to admit they passed or what it really says, they are trying to get all that back to get joined back together. And so, since they passed it, I have a copy of it. I see how it links to all these previous efforts where the people are on record. And if the confessions are made by people who have the influence to make it so, it's important to talk about it. And that's not theorizing. And again, conspiracies. The wrong word. It is a coordinated effort of using the institutions and another CAS BS Center for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Science book is it was called Nerves of Government, and they really foresee creating these think tanks and doing it at the state level and creating the narratives, and I've got those books, so I get to recognize how it's being done. I get to recognize that when you call pertinent facts to people's attention, they don't care. And that's when you've got somebody who's got a created narrative, is when facts don't change anything. They created this narrative in order to get quote, what they call the decision makers. And the decision makers can be a mayor, it can be a city council, it can be the school board, it can be the principal, but whoever the decision makers are, you create a sales pitch that will cause them to adopt certain policies or pass certain legislation that whether they understand it or not. So the legislators don't necessarily know what the real effect is. The parents don't know what the real effect is. The only people who understand the real effect are the people who created it. And like in education, a lot of the think tanks, their education expert, their background's not education, it's political science. So when somebody has a PhD in political science and they don't have respect for the facts and they push stories in order to get political authority to adopt certain policies, That's the way it needs to be understood. And they're using the levers of government to get certain results. And they are doing it in a coordinated vision. And they get together at conferences and they have broader societies. And we get to pay attention to that. You don't get to have a coordinated effort around political power, and then if somebody notices and documents it, goes conspiracist. It's not a get out of jail card,
right? Yeah, although they've outlawed it in the UK. I mean, conspiracy theory. They passed a law that, and so of course it has such a wide umbrella, like anything. That
what does the law say?
The law says is that conspiracy theory it branches under a form of extremism. So there's a law against extremism being a form of hate crime, I believe. I'm not actually quoting exactly, but there's a conflation of these things. Research into the kind of research you're doing, of course, could be branded as conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory can be branded as extremism. Extremism can then be put under the sort of hate crime. So there's this conflation of things once again, which...
When was it passed? Because they have passed some legislation that I actually wrote about, back in November that I came across, and it was all this stuff that they have passed pretty much in the name of citizenship in the UK. And this, what you're describing seems to be part of that general body of a vision that they were putting in place pretty much from about the year 2000 going forward. And it's all involves the community, and it gets at what it is you must believe.
And what you're allowed to talk about. I think it became particularly urgent in the UK because, as you may or may not have noticed, there's been more and more disclosures and revelations around the institutionalized sexual abuse of children, high levels of government, entertainment, and basically all the major institutions in the UK have been implicated in this kind of massive abuse of children. So
why?
Why what?
Why do you think in the UK in particular?
Why is it coming out there? Yeah, that's a very good question. I haven't really speculated about that. Just been following it and joining the dots and it's not just the UK, it's in Australia too, so you might actually more ask why is it not coming out in the US. Also in Belgium, there were actually riots in Belgium around Marc Dutroux and his clear connections to high-level government and abduction and sexual abuse of children. And it's evident across the Western world, really, these kind of agendas and these kind of crimes, but they're particularly suppressed in the US, where they tend to get dismissed under a sort of banner of satanic panic. So I think that would be a more pertinent question, is why is it not coming out in the US?
I don't know. I guess I hadn't realized that it was that bad in the UK. I tend to think of it more in Europe and the Netherlands, but once you are pushing a model that is okay to psychologically target kids to the extent that this model does, I'm not sure that any kind of use of the kids stays off limits long. I think you've broken through a barrier.
Yeah.
Of a complete lack of respect for who children are, and that you're entitled to mold them. And so I would worry that it's coming here.
Yeah, well, it may be there. It's more a question of whether it's being coming to the surface. And one of the things that I was pretty surprised to discover while looking into my family history and the connections to social psychology, Fabianism, and all that, is it seems as though research into child sexuality, and the effects of sexualizing children, I would say prematurely, but that wasn't their point of view, or at least it's very nuanced. But anyway, that was all part of the social engineering, or very central to social slash evolutionary engineering. Like, if you sexualize children very early on, then this will, of course, severely determine the way that they develop psychologically. It's an understatement, really.
It's part of addicting them to respond from emotion. I do know that some of the graphic sexualization that I'm seeing in K through 12, when you pull into it, it's clear that that's a way of habituating a reflex to respond from emotion, to react in a certain way to visuals, and unfortunately, they're using a guaranteed way, which is once you've got those images in the mind, that you've changed the mind itself.
Right. Well, yeah, let's zero on that, because there's a passage, several passages from your blog that I found that very much overlap with some of my research, and that relates exactly to what you just said about images. So, can I just read you a few passages from your blog, and that way we get
Absolutely.
summed up very quickly.
Okay.
So, a new site here, I want to ask you about this once I've finished, the noetic transformation template. It is sufficient to note that the presence of any image will affect a system in a certain way. And then you quote the SRI, that's the Stanford Research Institute. All these think tanks, like SRI, RAND, which is Fabian linked, Gorbis's Institute for the Future, Willis Harman's Institute for Noetic Sciences, are all fascinated by a hope for ability for the intervention of man into the evolutionary process. Yet such manipulation is the lied about and hidden push by a self-appointed elite over masses of people just trying to make their lives work and erroneously assuming K-12 schooling remains about the transmission of knowledge. So those seeking transformation first need to create beliefs about the nature of the system they want to change, and then plant beliefs about why it is unsatisfactory, and then prime for what should be changed. Education has always been useful for this goal, but the advent of computer gaming and immersion of students in virtual, deliberately created worlds takes the possibilities of implanting the desired images to a whole new level. That's precisely the real Common Core implementation targets. That's what digital learning is designed to assess and reshape if needed. The assessments have to be performances and activities because, as Harman said in 1988, persons may not realize they have these unconscious beliefs, but the beliefs can be inferred from behavior, from slips of the tongue, compulsive acts, body language, and so on. Now think about this next quote and whether the phrase Common Core may be a metaphor and not just a factual statement about skills and knowledge and consistency among students. Quote, "In the innermost core of the belief system are basic unconscious assumptions about the nature of the self and its relationship to others, and about the nature of the universe." Have you read Harman, the book that Harman contributed to, The Changing Images of Man?
I've also got his Global Mind Change book,
Okay.
and he was at RAND, and I believe at SRI for a while,
Yeah.
and it talks about it in the book. But then I mentioned Marina Gorbis, who speaking her Institute for the Future. I have her book too, and I've read it. Her Institute for the Future is working together with Knowledge Works on the vision for education. So I'm not just going back in time and finding troubling passages and linking them to current practices. I do that, but I also can see these people and what they're doing precisely right now, the ties to the classroom and to required practices going on in the classroom and to the reform the White House is pushing and the governors are pushing to change the nature of high school, and it all ties together.
Mm.
And there was a retreat at Bellagio. Bellagio is the Rockefeller Foundation's estate in Italy on Lake Como. And it was in 1968. And that was where they laid out this new conception of planning, and that it was going to be backward mapping, and it was going to be normative, and it was going to be this vision of the future as they wished it would be. And I had to teach myself Marxism because it kept coming up. And I discovered that there was this human development society that it's tied to a certain stage of technology, that there's this belief that the computer and internet is that stage of technology. But in the documents, there are about 500 pages out of that 1968 conference. And it talked about how there were some think tanks that are going to push this vision and help get this into place. And then it cited the Institute for the Future. And so another employee of Institute for the Future is a woman by the name of Jane McGonigal. She's written a book too, but more importantly, she was the keynoter at the big international digital education conference a couple years ago in Austin. And she was bragging about the fact that, you know, you create these games. She creates education games, video games, and you create them to have the visuals so that the student believes that, you know, there's global warming, that it's man-caused, that they have to do something or the world's coming. So you use the visuals, you use the emotions, you use the graphics to create this motivating belief in the students. And she lays it out in her book. She laid it out in the keynote. And these people are in a position of power. See, you see them referring to these entities. They're still around. They're doing keynotes. They're explaining how digital learning is going to allow them to achieve the goals. And then I look back to what those goals were originally at conferences decades ago and just try to draw that link. But now there's this consistency that everybody is pulling in a common direction. And now that I've gotten completely to the bottom of it, all it's doing is reinforcing what that vision is and how education ties into it and what the broader vision for society is, and this idea that you can plan a society around data, which is exactly what the White House is pushing under its open governance, open data initiative that was President Obama's very first action on his very first day in office. The day he got inaugurated, he did an executive order involving open data. And all of that's being used to try to, and then bring in the civil rights laws and argue that if you've got a difference in outcomes and you can tie it to poverty or race or any of these other factors, that you can pull the civil rights and say, and this is something Arne Duncan was also trying to push at the Education Department. If there's a difference in outcomes for like discipline practices, then necessarily that's inequitable and a problem under civil rights laws. Well, people have different life experiences. They've got different abilities. So essentially, by insisting that you must close the achievement gap, you pretty much have specified that what's going on in the classroom can't be about transmission of knowledge. It can't be academically oriented in the traditional sense, because people don't have the same ability to do algebra, and they never have. What made somebody an A-plus student was that ability to take facts and put them into what they had in common and how they were different. And the B student knew the facts but couldn't do the broader framework and figure that out for themselves. The C student didn't know the facts, But the A-plus student was the one who could figure out their own framework. Well, now that you've said everybody has to get the common outcomes, you're creating this reason to provide the ideology that people are going to perceive the world to. Because everybody can't come up with their own framework. You're not making education fact-based anymore. So you're providing the beliefs. You're providing the ideas. Common Core calls it CDIs, core disciplinary ideas, and CCCs, cross-cutting concepts and themes. So you're providing these ideological ways to see the world, and then checking to see if you ask students an open-ended question where there is no right answer, what concepts do they want to bring into play? What strategies are they using? And again, that's the information the behavioral scientists need to know, because those are the strategies, those are the ideas you're going to bring into play in ordinary life. Those are the strategies that you're seeing the world through. And so you've got a tremendous amount of manipulation now that's going on into prescribing those.
Right. So basically describing the Borg.
Yeah, without a recognition, it's there. Yeah. And so that's what I do. The first step, it's not that I'm naive about the influence I can have, but the first step is for people to recognize that their assumptions about what's going on in the neighborhood classroom and what these terms really mean are inconsistent with the facts, and start asking. You know, I was at a program, and there were several state legislators speaking, and I know how all this ties together, but what I wanted to know was, do the legislators know this? Does your mayor understand this is how this all? So they asked, you know, does anybody have a question? So I raised my hand and said, isn't it true that the reason there's not any traction in the legislature to repeal the Common Core, no matter how controversial it is, and the legislature sees it as tied to economic development and workforce development. And they immediately said, yes, that's right. And then they realized that they really didn't want to be quoted as saying that's right, because most people, the idea that education has become about workforce development and that politicians get to specify all of that, like it or not, is not politically popular.
Of course.
So it wasn't a shock, but then they were kind of backpedaling a little bit and wishing that they could take back their reflexes. Yeah, we know that. And I would gather that's pretty true if you talk to most politicians, that they think that they get to call the shots, all the shots now. And you've never had mass prosperity anywhere where politicians get to call all the shots, because what drives them is not really what's in anyone's best interest. It's what is in the best interest of either the people that contribute to them, or the fact that their day job is working as a lobbyist for, you know, various groups. And so it goes back to what I was saying. A lot of this is getting put in place because you've got created conflicts of interest, so that the person who is the decision maker has no incentive to actually get to the bottom of what's really going on, and every incentive in the world to push what's this behavioral science template. And it's not affecting them. It's not their money. There's a promotion in it, and maybe a good pension if this is what they push. So all of this, they can get funding from the NSF or the National Institutes of Health, or all of this is going forward, but it's and it's involving taxpayer money and involving grants and federal agents. I mean, back in 2014, the White House started setting what they call the BRAIN Initiative. I mean, they're literally mapping the brain, and they're mapping the brain to figure out when you use these behavioral science oriented programs in the classroom, which parts of the brain seem to be affected? It's just you read it and it's shocking. But there's not a dispute that it's going on. It's just not something they trumpet.
Right.
So I'm trumpeting it. And you're helping.
I definitely like to go back to that noetic transformation template.
Okay. I didn't make up that word. I actually pulled that out of yet another social planning book, and they talked about going after the noetic.
Okay. So, but you also cite the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is something that I've come across various times in my own research, which has been more spiritually oriented. Like, I've been a spiritual seeker, quote unquote, for a large part of my life, and one of the things I've been uncovering in the last few years is how much of that has been compromised or even created as, you know, part of these guiding fictions.
Altered consciousness.
Yeah, that whole memeplex, if you will.
Edwin Mitchell you know, passed away within the last couple months, and somebody made a comment about, oh, isn't it sad he passed away? And I said, gee, do you know what he was into most of his life? This was what he created, and this is what it pushed. And
oh, so you've researched Edgar Mitchell, because I also, he pops up constantly in my own stuff. So yeah, what have you uncovered about Mitchell?
Just it's really more the fact that Willis was at the Institute for Noetic Sciences, and I think what I recall about Edgar, because I've not read a book of his, I've read several from Willis Harmon, is something along the lines of that when he was in outer space and he saw the vision of the world out of his window, that's when it struck him that we were all one humanity. And he wanted to make sure that was recognized around the world. There's a
absolutely the overview effect is what it's called, and so I think he created the Overview Institute. Joseph Campbell, who also was on Changing Images of Man, who contributed to it. He promoted this idea also. And Mitchell took it as far as suggesting or even outright stating that for humanity to become enlightened, we needed to leave the planet.
Yeah, when I made the decision to put the book aside, even though I finished it and start the blog, one of the reasons I did was I had come across this Planet Under Pressure conference that was in March of 2000. And 12, and in the Planet Under Pressure conference, basically laid out something called the Belmont Challenge and the Earth System Partnership, and it had started in 2009. It was named out. It had meetings at the Belmont House. The UK and the US are the lead sponsors of it. But it basically was all about reengineering society. And one of the speakers at the conference, which horrified me, and I've written about, and I think I'm still about the only person that's written about, and I've got all the original documents, was there was a professor speaking at the conference by the name of Stephen Sterling over in England. And he had written a dissertation that was unaltered consciousness and getting to the various stages. And it must have been talked about at that conference, that Planet Under Pressure conference, because all of a sudden that dissertation was way high on Google when I went looking for who he was, as if it had been downloaded a lot about the time of that conference. And I think that was one of the first times that I really came to grips with just how much they intend to alter your mind. And I don't know if you're familiar with Ken Wilber's work, Integral Theory.
Somewhat, yeah.
Somewhat, okay. Well, Ken Wilber's kind of partner in Integral Theory is a Harvard education professor by the name of Robert Keegan. And Robert Keegan's work is what is the competences that they're looking for now in higher education. And the Hewlett Foundation hired Robert Keegan and an MIT professor by the name of Peter Senge, S-E-N-G-E, to look at the Common Core assessments and see if they were going to be measuring the kind of deeper learning that they wanted to see measured. And so there's ties among all this. There are ties. Rhianne Eisler, she's a lot of the what are called the new three R's, rigor, relevance, and relationship, and the compassionate. But it's a lot of her vision of society is tied into what's being pushed in the classroom. And you have to get beyond the little bit of the rhetoric, but you get down where the required practices will track back to something she wrote, and the rest of her vision is attached to, except for the rest of the vision is not something that the people pushing it in the classroom would have been familiar with, but it's still tied to where this is all intended to go. And Rhianne Eisler was involved with a group that was called the General Evolution Research Group, and it's the idea that you can use education to change, probably media too, use education and the media to force cultural change and do it at the level of the mind, and that you can drive it. And you know, there are reports from this group. These people were, some of them are still around. And so we're still, the term excellence, which is, you know, there was a White House commission, the Commission on Excellence and Equity. Excellence is what gets pushed by a lot of school system, and it all ties back to this General Evolution Research Group. So it's everything that's going on is tied together. It's pretty consistent vision, but it's taken me about 5 years of full-time research to truly get to the bottom of this. And I have hundreds of books of laying all this out.
Have you bumped into NASA so far with your research?
Not NASA so much. I run into DARPA sometimes. But not really NASA.
Because there's a very close, if not exact, match with your guiding fictions with NASA, which is something that they published examples of. They called it scenario planning, and it's almost the same thing, but very specifically in terms of creating scenarios for the future, written as past tense narratives, basically science fiction, that lay out the kind of changes that they want to see happen at the social level, but specifically relating to technology and space travel, space colonization.
Site knowledge in education, that's the term that they use. Yeah, same. It's the exact same thing.
Foresight knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that overlap, I mean, they were doing it with their think tanks, you know, inside NASA, but it overlapped clearly with pop culture, so with Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek and countless movies where they had a hand in shaping the narratives that were used in pop cultural artifacts in order to kind of seed those desires and those images in new generations so that then they would consciously or unconsciously bring them about.
Yeah, I've noticed that and had mentioned it to my kids before and they roll their eyes at me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've noticed the same thing.
Yeah.
There are times that my kids teasing will refer to the research I do as Mom's Illuminati Project, even though I've never used that term.
But yeah, of course, yeah. So, but because they're familiar with that whole, the less reputable representations of this data on YouTube and all the rest of it, presumably conspiratainment.
I guess they just, you know. They just like to tease me, I think. It's so they also have found it interesting that instead of teachers being annoyed that I do this, teachers by and large think that my dragging this, the true intentions of what they're being forced to do in the classroom, into the open is the only chance they have to stay in the profession and avoid having to do this long term. So they like it, that I do this research and document it and explain how things are linked together and why they really are stripping away tenure, and it's not so that they can get that incompetent science teacher out of the classroom. It's so that they can get that non-compliant able teacher out of the classroom who still wants to push a transmission of knowledge. Those are the teachers that have been threatened with job loss.
Yeah, for saying the wrong thing, for example.
Or still wanting to have a transmission of knowledge curriculum. I've got teachers who are award-winning teachers who have been told that if they don't make the computer the point of their English classroom, that they instead of quality books, that they need to find a new job. And that's in private schools.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's all tied together, and a lot of the research involving the behavioral sciences, some of it came out of originally being used for defense purposes, and then the broader implications being appreciated, and then like I said, they had gone used it in marketing and public relations, and I wrote a post about two posts ago and saying basically, you know, what was controversial when it was used in PR is the same research that's being used in education, except for at least the people pushing it were aware of what they were pushing. Now there's so many layers of deceit and so many euphemisms for this. The fact that we're imposing this on the classroom, small children, so that it takes root at a brain-based neurological level, and then we monitor to make sure it is in place. That's horrifying, and it's not accurately understood. And that's why it's so important in my mind to tell the story. And this is, when accurately told, it's not okay with anybody, except for the people which create the conflicts of interest, and they're benefiting from it, but it's not okay with anybody else.
Yeah, that's also my approach with uncovering the institutionalized sexual abuse of children and throughout all of this, because rather than trying to interpret the data and say this is not okay because this and this and this and that and the other, but once all the facts are on the table, they're so horrific that there's really no way anybody could say that this is okay.
Yeah.
Really.
You know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And once we can document what's going on, once we can document the effects of it, once we can document that this is in practice, we need to talk about it.
Yeah. So I mentioned the Borg. It was a bit of a throwaway, the comment about the Borg, but it was with a serious intent, because it does seem as though what you're mapping and what I'm mapping and what we are seeing, those of us who are looking, it does have some really deeply disturbing implications in terms of the colonization of our interior space, let's say. I've tried to explore this, and it's very difficult to talk about outside the realms of science fiction, but maybe that's part of how we've been manipulated, in the sense that we get these fictional narratives that closely represent what's going on, but because they're fictional, they don't seem grounded in anything real, whereas what actually is going on is so difficult to comprehend. We just see the pieces. But for example, the pieces to do with computerization of psychology, which is a term that you use at your blog, in terms of the introducing computers more and more into the education system, in terms of the gathering of data through computers of society and of human individuals, the whole NSA thing, which is now public knowledge, that they're constantly collecting information, personal information about us. Where's all that going? It's all getting crunched into some vast computer and then somehow sorted and processed. I theorize about this in fiction because I don't know how to write about it in any other way, that it seems as though there's an attempt to create a kind of artificial intelligence but using human experience to do it, and that the flip side of that seems to be that we are being implanted with that artificial intelligence structure. So, like, we're being taught, we're being directed what to think, we're being incepted with these images that then will be the core of our consciousness. So it really is like a science fiction scenario.
A lot of the people that are involved in this have in education have artificial intelligence degrees, frequently from MIT.
Really?
Yeah, so it's, and I have, that's part of what the second book's about. This is something I have spent a lot of time on, and I've got what the hopes for it when it, these conferences were set up, the cybernetics. I've got Norbert Wiener's work, and so I'm not speculating that my second book will literally be about why they're targeting, how they're doing it, what the hopes were, what it looks like, and it's as if they want to program people as if they were computers, and then let computers be as lifelike. So everybody gets programmed in the end. Mm. And but it's all tied together. It's you can see the similarities and think that it's probably related, but I've tracked all this to a level where the people are describing what they intend to do, who they are, and, you know, I can see the impact on the classroom now. I can see that Edutopia is pushing so-and-so's work, and so-and-so was the research assistant to Piaget, and that what's being described as constructionism and mandated for the classroom, it fits the template for how cybernetics was supposed to work, and they're basically treating people as if they're a cybernetic social engineering project, and the way all that ties together is required under the new federal education statute for annual assessments. That's how all this, this isn't a matter of this interests me. This matters. This is, we have passed federal legislation mandating practices for the classroom involving every student that tracks to these planning conferences, that tracks to the Soviet Union and how they wrote that they could achieve a scientific management of society. It tracks to how you want to control thought, so that instead of having an ability to speculate in your own mind how things might turn out, that you really want somebody to have a level of thought that it, where knowledge is about whether they can achieve, you call human beings a goal-setting system, and that knowledge becomes about what they need to know to meet their goals. And that's what competency actually means. So when you talk, you have your governor or you've got the state chamber of commerce saying that they want competency-based education, it is my hope that they have no idea what that really means. But whether they have an idea or not, it doesn't change the nature of what competency-based education is and how it ties to outcomes-based education and systems thinking. And systems thinking is another thing that's now required under federal law, because it was on like page 500 and something of the WIOA statute I mentioned. They list things that all students must be able to do to be deemed workforce ready. And one of them is systems thinking.
Hmm.
And again, systems, well, the way they have that, it's a guiding fiction. It's not how the world works, but it's useful for people with aspirations of social engineering and steering of people in the economy by political power to get people to think of the world in ways that it's not actually, but if they believe that, then you can change how the world works, but it won't work successfully that way. So they intend to do this. That's what they're trying to get into place, but what they don't understand are the consequences of what they're trying to do, because they've, you know, spent all their life, for example, on the public payroll or chasing after research grants, where if they push X idea involving the behavioral science, they get more research grant. Well, if that's your idea of how you get a paycheck, you're not going to appreciate the long-term implications of pushing these, all this social engineering. So it's very troubling, but there's not a dispute about what they're trying to do through education. It's just it had to be uncovered.
So presumably you've also been looking into transhumanism and all of that area, that field.
Some of it. Under my three cap rule.
Yeah.
If I haven't gone after transhumanism per se.
Because that's Wilbur as well is linked, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I mean, tracking all this though makes me recognize that agenda when I encounter it though, and how it ties to all these other things. So, I'm sure I'll get there, but I'm always coming from what I'm dealing with and what the actual require and what all it links to.
Sure.
People will send me stuff and say, I can tell from having read your book, reading your blog, that this is problematic, but I can't tell exactly why. Can you look at this? And I'll look at it and I can tell in about 10 minutes exactly how it's going to work, what else it's tied to. So,
yeah, I don't think you'll be able to avoid the black hole of transhumanism for very long, based on what you've just said. And it's really kind of mind-boggling. And one of the questions I would have had for you, if you were familiar with it, was whether these people like Ray Kurzweil or Sims Bainbridge, creating these guiding fictions, whether they themselves actually believe in them. I mean, like, one of the tenets of transhumanism is that we're just data. You know, we are just our thoughts, and so our identities, who we actually are just thought-based, and so that can be converted into digital data and then downloaded or just turned into a cloud, and so we can exist eternally through, you know, as data. And the implications for space travel, and, you know, I mean, it's crazy talk. It seems completely dissociated, but at a certain point it becomes kind of a chicken or an egg thing. It's like, are these guiding fictions created in order to perpetuate dissociation, or are they the result? Are they symptoms of dissociation? So, you know, do people actually believe these things?
I would say, because generally when I read a book, I don't just read whatever the passage is I've quoted. I'll read the whole book so I make sure I really understand what it is these people want to do. I would say, by and large, most of them think that they're smarter than virtually anybody else, and that they are developing theories that will be good for them, and that whatever decision they come up with, the people will be better off than what they would come up with on their own. There's a lot of power and there's a lot of New Age spirituality that comes up involving people involved in this, that it happens with way too much frequency for it not to be related. But again, until I can get an open admission or find it in their own words, I try not to speculate. And if I have a joke, if I'm speculating, it's in my own head or me talking to it with my cat. But until I'm absolutely sure, so I know that there is correlation. I know that the mindfulness practices are coming in to the classroom, that as legal mandates, and involving small kids, and that when parents object, they're getting nowhere. And it's a little bit like the images we were talking about in the pornography and the graphic sexuality. They want to habituate the kids early enough. I talk about this a good bit in my book, Credential to Destroy, but they're very aware that malleable period is over with by about age 12 to 14. And so they feel the need to do it in preschool, do it in elementary school and middle school, and have it locked in neurologically, and have it be what guides behavior. That's the deep learning. When you push and push and push, it's how you perceive the world and what guides your behavior and what motivates your behavior. and in a world, what it is that's going to drive your decisions. And all of that's being manipulated and stipulated, and the people involved, the students, their parents, taxpayers, nobody's being told how all this fits together. Well, unless they read my stuff, because that's what I explain, how it all fits together, and that there isn't a dispute about this. And everything I know about what's being internalized and this, what I call the cybernetic component of all this, and that's tied to artificial intelligence, all of that is still ultimately grounded in appreciating that it's not about the transmission of knowledge, why they keep coming back to this competency template, how it was so important to stop accurate using accurate methods for teaching reading or math, and you know what I call that axe maker mind. Once the axe maker mind is there, the behavioral science techniques won't work. And so what I tell parents, the number one thing you can do is to make sure your child becomes a fluent reader. Because if they're a fluent reader, you can bore them, you can annoy them, but they really can't engineer them in the way they want to. So think of that as a vaccination for kids.
The Scandinavian countries are kind of paving the way for this.
Absolutely. I laid that out in my book, that when they created the PISA that you frequently hear when they talk about are we competitive internationally or not? They're talking about these assessments that aren't about knowledge, and the assessments were created to drive education globally in the direction of this common behavioral science template. So if you're chasing after being internationally competitive, you're inherently pushing this behavioral science agenda, but most politicians don't know that. And the in order to kind of standardize it all over the world, the OECD set up, starting in 1998, the PISA test of 15-year-olds, and it's tied to something called DSECA, the Definition and Selection of Competences. And at the time that they set up the DSECA model, which again wasn't knowledge-based, they the Scandinavian countries, including Finland, were already beyond that in the model. So they had moved that far away from academics already, and they were already pursuing it's what's called the Learning Society vision. And so their books from the guy that created the Learning Society vision. There's another book called The New Totalitarians that I actually have and have read. The use of the study circles in Scandinavia is the same. They're not called study circles now, but you've got parent after parent coming home and saying, you know, that they set up the desks in a circle at the school, and they talk about their feelings, and they talk about all these personal issues, and it's the reincarnation of the Scandinavian study circles for the same purposes, but it's not being accurately explained to the parents, and it may have a new name, but yeah, all of this is has already gone on over there. And in emulating Finland, you're emulating their vision of the learning society that's getting everyone kind of to the same place in an expectation that they will cooperate and not compete, and that they will see themselves as a group, a member of a group, and not as an individual, and not as entitled to go their own way and have their own thoughts and have their own reasons and have that respected.
And is the, would you say that the Steiner's Waldorf school is part of this? Because didn't I read that it had just become the schooling in, the accepted schooling in Norway?
I think I've seen that too. It is tied to the Waldorf. I've never had a kid in a Waldorf school, so, I have seen attributions in some of the documents where they're laying out what they intend to do, and the planners will tie it to the vision of the Waldorf school.
Okay. So I'm sure you encounter difficulties in terms of communicating this to people in general, but specifically like I have yoga. I do yoga twice a week, and the teacher there is in his 70s, very nice chap. He was talking about the Waldorf school briefly and how great it is, and yeah, I don't know. I know one person who went there. He didn't like it because he had to knit as a guy, and so that seemed a bit cookie. But you know, as far as I know, and based on my own experiences at school, it seemed like the lesser of two evils, at least. So, how do you kind of introduce this very unfamiliar viewpoint to people who have already been conditioned and indoctrinated to believe in the very values that you're describing as so manipulative and potentially destructive?
What I have found is, and what's laid out in my book, 5 years from now, it's still going to be the story. It's more pertinent now than it was when I wrote it. This is it. This is the purpose. It's well documented.
Yeah.
What I have found is that because it's not a pleasant thing to think about, there needs to be something in somebody's life that causes them to recognize that what's going on in the school is not healthy for their child. It's not what they thought was going on. And they find me.
Right.
They find some interview I've given. They find my blog. They read about the book because they're looking at something else on Amazon, whatever. And they'll read, they'll seek me out.
Mm.
And so, and I'm lucky in that my kids are grown. So, this is a template I've been trying to protect them against, but it's not a template that I'm going to have to experience in my daily life. And it makes it easier for me to tell about it. But the parents that are living it and have kids in elementary schools, and what they tell me is that understanding what's being targeted, even though they wish in some ways they didn't know, is the only way to protect their child. And the only way to have conversations with their child about the whole psychological emphasis in the classroom, that they step in and make sure that the child is taught to read properly and don't just take the school's word for it. They understand that these assessments aren't tests. They understand that a lot of the anti-Common Core agenda and the hype that they've deliberately hyped up the testing and the assessments in order to create a popular outcry in order to push formative assessments, which are far more intrusive than what people were upset about. So it's one of those things that they are calculatingly asking people to seek a remedy that makes the situation worse.
A problem reaction solution.
Yep.
Thing.
So yeah. It's I, like I said, telling the story is the only way out. It's a well-documented story now, and I try to tell it with humor. I try to interject stories from other writers so that I'm not just telling what's going on. I try to tell from history why it matters and what the likely implications are. It's why it can be, you know, I said I had the book, The New Totalitarians, that was about what was going on in Scandinavia in the early, I think it was written in 1971 or 72. And I've got Torsten Hussein, H-U-S-E-N, his book on the Learning Society that was from the same time period. He was from Norway. And if you know it's already been implemented there and you know how it works, I can look there and I can see what the consequences have been. And that gives me some insights into what the likely consequences are going to be here. You know, one of the things that has always bothered me that I've been aware of for a while is the places where you've had the tragic school shootings are almost always places that have been pushing this behavioral science approach. So where you've got some sort of snapping that causes them to want to lash out at the school and their classmates and their teachers, and almost invariably will track with being an area that was cutting edge on this. Paducah, Kentucky, Oregon, Columbine, the shooter in the theater shooting, who was pushing, who had a neuroscience background, a behavioral science. His high school template, I was able to get the accreditation. It was a brand new high school, and they laid out exactly what they were pushing, and I recognize it. So I think that this is a template that breaks the trust of children in the adults in their lives, because the bright ones recognize that they're being manipulated at school and that it's beyond their control. And a certain small percentage, but a deadly percentage, seems to then make a connection with the school not being a safe place, and they're forced to be there. And it doesn't cause it, but it's too consistent across time for it there not to be some kind of connection.
Are you familiar with liminality, with the concept, anthropological concept of liminality?
No.
That's what the podcast is kind of named after. It seems relevant to what you're describing. It's certainly the first thing that came to my mind is that cultures or communities in the past recognized that there are liminal periods for a community and for the individual, and they would have ceremonies around them. So, for example, when a child is coming of age, they would create a liminal space, a ceremony to a rite of passage, and so to mark that transition. And it was about that all the laws of the community were suspended during that time, and the adolescents would be guided by a ceremony master from one state to the other, but they were given a space, a liminal space, in which essentially they could do absolutely anything. They had to be allowed to express whatever was in them, and trust that the ceremony master and the community itself, even in this liminal state, would hold a safe space for that. And as they went through that passage, came out the other side, led by the ceremony master, then they became adults. And one of the things that I've been looking into is how liminality can be perpetuated. So it's basically a state of chaos. It means there's no structure, or the structures that do exist aren't stable. And one of the ways to exploit and control people is to perpetuate liminality, and then the false ceremony masters can put themselves forward, charismatic leaders, in order to guide people, well, misguide them, manipulate them, and exploit them, because they're desperate. They feel that they're in this liminal state, and they don't know, you know, what's what. They don't know what to believe, and so they will look to leaders. They will look to the authorities, to the institutions, even no matter how untrustworthy they are. Essentially, they have to look outside of themselves to be guided. So it's kind of the opposite. A false ceremony master has the opposite function to a true ceremony master, who leads the person in a liminal state to a sense of their own core, and the false ceremony master just constantly keeps them disconnected from that, dissociated, so they can be manipulated. And so, yeah, it seems as though that would relate to what they're doing in these schools, is because they're, by asking questions that there are no answers to, for it, just to give one obvious example, they're perpetuating this liminality of, well, the student doesn't know what's what, and is not being given anything to hold on to, no facts, no ground. And then
you're deliberately introducing cognitive dissonance, and they call it rigor. I mean, rigor is what you do when there is no correct answer, or you've never been taught the material. And it is deliberately used as a technique to try to get at these deep motivation and ideas driving how you see the world when there isn't a set answer. But it is a very intrusive practice. And so, to use your example, if the place where that's supposed to be safe is where somebody goes back to wreak havoc, we would over time start to get the idea that the practice is going on in that place on a safe space. And that's what's happening at school, because nobody wants to deal with the real implications of this behavioral science template, because it's buried pretty deep. And most of the people who understand what is really going on have a financial conflict of interest not to tell the true story. And so you get somebody like me who gets at the behavioral science element and has now learned anytime there's a school shooting to go looking for exactly where they are on the level of pushing transmission of knowledge versus changing the child. And the extent to which I run into that in the places, the schools that these bad people, but who turned on other people and connected in a certain way, I always find this behavioral science template as having been a active part of their school experience for years.
Mm-hmm.
And So I think there is a connection. I've got a kid who's about to come home, so I need to kind of wind this up in the next couple minutes.
Okay. Yeah, I guess we've been a long time. I was going to ask about Scandinavia, but maybe save it. Well, I'll just ask very quickly. Do you have any idea or reason why those countries are particularly paving the way, what it is about Scandinavia that makes them the template?
They're smaller countries. They they went to a welfare state right after World War II in most instances. The guy was talking about Torsten Hussein, Husen, who was also the one of the people who set up with Benjamin Bloom the International Education Assessment, and literally wrote about the fact that they had created these assessments in order to drive countries globally towards this behavioral science vision of how to change people so they were more amenable to the real communist agenda, which, and I don't mean big C communist as in the Soviet Union. When I write about it, I usually refer to it as the little C communism vision. And again, that's the vision that at a certain level of technology that you're ready to have the redistribution go on. But that level of prosperity, we've gotten to the technology, requires you to change the values and the belief system of people. And that's what the Scandinavians understood, and they went to it first. And in the book, The New Totalitarians, the guy writes about, he goes, you know, I still remember, you know, what built my business, that being an individual and going my own way and coming up with the ideas that other people hadn't appreciated. But I wouldn't want my grandchildren to still be individuals, because this would be a very painful society to live in. And so some people are aware, some take it for granted, but they're very far along over in Norway. And then Hussein wrote a sequel called The Learning Society Revisited in 1987. Got that too, read that too. So I'm not speculating on the connections. I chase after it until I can use people's own words. And what's scary is when, having chased it down to that level, knowing what the purposes of the practices are, that's what I see in the schools. And that's what I see in federal statutes. And then there's not really a dispute of what the consequences are likely to be. And that can be the importance of looking over to the UK or Australia or to Scandinavia, because it can tell me it's exactly where we're going to be in 5 years in U.S. schools, unless we recognize the nature of what we're forcing on the classrooms and on our children.
Did you know, by the way, that just a quick little point, that Karl Marx was hanging out in the British Museum at the same time George Bernard Shaw was, and that he died the same year that Fabian Society was founded?
That doesn't surprise me.
I just thought that might be a relevant connection at some point.
You know, I think the Fabians, you know, one of the books that I have that I was surprised about the being the tied to the Center for Advanced Studies in Behavioral Science, it was something Daniel Bell, who's actually still alive, he's the one that wrote about, you know, the post-industrial society. And Daniel Bell talks about how there were all these documents from the early part of Marx's writings that described this human development society and the vision for education and the full potential, and that the economic writings weren't the true story. And so the little C communism, the human development, what we're dealing with now, what got launched in 1962 globally as Marxist humanism, all of that is from writing that stayed in German until I think like in the 30s or maybe 40s. and got translated late. And that's, and Bell in this book from 57 talks about how they now understand what Karl Marx's true vision was in a way that Lenin would never have had access to, because they weren't available and weren't really, they were still unpublished at the time that the Soviet Union was created. So unfortunately, the Fabians and the behavioral scientists here and educators and politicians, they now have access to what they think the true vision is. And it involves technology, and it involves, and that's what they're trying to impose through education. And I don't think it's going to work very well. So that's what we're dealing with.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
Right, that's it then. Next week's Liminalist, I'll be talking to Gary Haidt again, and after that I'll be talking to Mark Golding. I was supposed to talk to Dan Mitchell of Luminosity, the blogger who comes and goes with frightening regularity, yesterday I was supposed to, but I don't know, it didn't happen. Just no sign of Dan, but then I noticed that his blog is taken down again. Actually, I've never followed Dan's blog. I only came upon it because he linked to my recent stuff about Lily Streber. Reached out, he seemed interested in sharing experiences, but I guess something intervened. I don't know what it was, may never find out. Which makes me want to talk about all the people who were supposed to be on this podcast and ended up not being. Well, there's quite a few anyway who have said they would do it and then just bowed out without another word. Gordon White was one who dicked me around. I had no idea what was going on there. He did it twice in succession, saying, yeah, yeah, let's do it, and then stopped answering my emails. Another one is the artist Carson Mell, who I was just reminded of in my Twitter feed for some reason. He was interested in Streber and interested in being a podcast, and then just started ignoring my emails. I wonder what that is. Kind of a pattern. Ramsey Dukes was kind of an acquaintance, I wouldn't say a friend. He said he was interested in doing a podcast various times, but just never got back to me on it, and then I saw he was on Gordon White's podcast, which I didn't listen to. Anyway, I think Ramsey doesn't want to do, maybe doesn't want to do this podcast because I'm looking into the deeper, darker underlayers of occultism and whatnot, and he's clearly ensconced in that. Who else? Guy Madden agreed to do the podcast, but then got overwhelmed and just kind of got testy with my email, so I just said, okay, never mind. Stephen Kent said yes, but just procrastinated so much and not responded by last, so nothing happening there. Joe Swanberg didn't get back to me, even though he said he would do it. Roger Avery, or rather his assistant, said he would do one, I think in May, to get back to him in May. That was almost a year ago. Gosh, well, I'm sure there's a long list. I don't remember them. But just recently, quite a few seem that are not panning out. I'm just kind of waiting now, in a sort of holding pattern now, in terms of what's next. I'm sure I got more to say, I just can't think what it is. Peter Watts, George Hansen and John Michael Greer all have Prisoner Infinity. I'm hoping that at some point I'll get to talk about it with them on this podcast. It's one of them. But that is out of my hands, like everything else. Finally. Right, well, thanks everyone for listening and participating in this experiment, such as it is. I think that's all for this week. Till next time, liminally signing off into the emptiness of silence.
The mankind, and this was all that monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down.